Welcome back to the Music and Movie Club podcast. I'm John Kissel. With me tonight is J.R. Peters.
Yo, what's up?
Here at the Music and Movie Club, we're a group of friends who, every month, select three movies to review on our website, musicandmovie.club. And then, after those three movies have been reviewed, we get together to discuss said three movies on this podcast. This last month, we went with, kind of unofficially, movies starring black female leads. That's just kind of how it worked out. But that's good. We haven't done a lot of female-led movies recently anyway. So, great. Yeah, this is kind of like a JR impetus trio that we selected. We'll say it's Black History Month. And, you know, the U.S. gives black people 1 month a year, and we kind of do the same thing here at the Music and Movie Club. So the movies we picked this last month were Love and Basketball and The Woman King and What's Love Got to Do with It. We're going to start with Love and Basketball. This is a movie directed by Gina Prince Bythewood. It is her first movie. It is starring Omar Epps and Sanaa Lathan as two neighbors who first meet each other when they're like 10, 11 years old, give or take. And then the film follows them as they progress through high school and college and young adulthood. As they progress their basketball career. JR, what did you think of Love and Basketball?
I absolutely love Love and Basketball. I enjoy it more than it is a good movie, right? This is like a lot of nostalgia for me. You know, when did this movie come out? When I was probably like, yeah, I was 8 when this movie came out. Probably watched it that same year with my family. I think it's a great movie. It's probably a B plus movie, but if you ask me how much I love it, it's the love for this movie is an A plus, pure A plus. I love everything about it. There's only a couple of things that I guess we can talk about later that I really think it misses on, but for the most part, I think it's a great like 90s era movie. You know,
I will second your love for Love and Basketball. This is fantastic. I saw this movie for the first time only a few years ago in a theater that was playing it down here for like a repertory showing, and I was certainly aware of it. It does everything well. I'm very interested to hear what you think it doesn't do well, because I think it nails everything that it's trying to do. I have it as an A-, but I don't really have a good reason for that. I think I kind of want to go the full A. We've talked previously. I can't remember exactly what movie spurred this particular thread of conversation, but like 2000 is like right in the thick of this period of a lot of black-led movies, not necessarily black-directed. I would say black-directed too.
Most of them.
Yeah, in the mid to late 90s going through, I don't know exactly when it would have ended, like 2000, 2001, 2002, where you get a lot of like star-making performances from actors, you get a lot of directors assembling repertory casts, working with the same people over and over again. And I definitely think this is one of the better of that era. And the thing that separates that era, that period from today, and I definitely think that this like ended, like that this went away in like the mid to late 2000s and the 2010s before coming back. Not that either period is like swimming in, Hollywood representation, but what I think distinguishes this period that we're currently in from like late 90s, 2000s, is that the movies are starring black people, but they're not necessarily about black people, if that makes sense. And, you know, if I'm full of shit, tell me I'm full of shit. Movies like Get Out, like Sorry to Bother You, like Blindspotting, et cetera, et cetera. Like those movies are about their characters, but they're also very much about what it means to be black in America at this specific period in time. Whereas it's not crazy to imagine 11 basketball that casts white people in the leads.
Yeah, I agree. The movie with that spurred that whole conversation was Eve Bayou last year.
Yeah,
when when I did my Black History Month picks for 2022. Yes.
Yeah.
But I think it's like this. So you get what Love and Basketball probably made like $30,000 or, you know,
$30 million.
Yeah, probably made $30 million. So this is in the 90s. They're like willing to just any money you make, you make. So they're cool with giving black people these movies. And this is a whole thing. I think it, this is like a more of a lower mid-range movie, even for the 90s. But that's how, where all of these movies about black people, not about black people, but just movies with black people in them fit in the 90s. And then they probably started moving towards, we do need to make more money. So then you get those like 2000s movies where you get the, you get like the Hangover type movie and, you know, Knocked Up and shit. Those movies are still middle movies, but they're going to make more money. And then we lose those movies and we're coming back around towards that. But it doesn't seem like, you were saying, it, they're more leaning towards just being about being black versus, which is not a problem, but it's just like a whole different take. But they're still, we haven't hit this level of like middle movie again, really, outside of movies that are looking to win an Oscar, right? So we don't have movies really where they're Love and Basketball level of money being put into them and everything, where it's like, we're just going to make a movie and it's going to be, people are going to enjoy it. They're like, your middle movies are the ones going for Oscars. You got a little bit up above that. And that's Nope, not necessarily going for an Oscar. At Nope, and, you know, not necessarily going for an Oscar, but they know they're going to make money off this, like make a lot of money off this movie.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a blockbuster.
Yeah. It's still going to be a blockbuster, but not like fucking MCU level blockbuster.
Sure.
I think we're missing this middle movie where it's just like, they're making a good movie here. And that's, I think that's where in lies, you get Love and Basketball. You get, you know, Best Man Holiday. Yeah. You know, Best Man, all those 90s black people, black 90s, you call them black people movies, but like you said, they're just movies. Like none of them are like, we grew up in the hood. There's some Boys in the Hood, Menace to Society, but a lot of these movies are just like niggas hanging out, black people hanging out, black people living their lives. And this is one of the better ones, like you were saying. Yeah.
That Boys in the Hood, Menace to Society era, it feels like that gives way to like middle class black life.
It does. That's also beginning, right?
Boys in the Hood's like 90. South Central, like LA type movies, like those kind of go away.
Yeah. And then you get some are still being made towards the end, but they don't like get the same, they're not like talked about of the same. So those, Menace to Society and Boys in the Hood are early 90s, late 80s. Yeah. And then as you get towards the middle, like that movie Juice that comes out, right? Or is that still early? No, that's still like
94,
early.
95.
It's 92. So So I think you're right. I was going to say Juice was like 96. And that would be like the outlier in the 96 era. But I don't think, with it coming out in 92, I think that's still around the time of Menace to Society. So I 100% agree with you. I mean, this is, we'd have to look at this. And I'm sure somebody has. We could. Yeah.
Who did the recent like black film canon? Slate did one a few years ago, but there was another one. It might have been Slate again.
I think they redid it. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, because last time they did like 20 movies, I think they did 100 this time.
Okay. Yeah, I think like in 2018, 2019, and then they just recently redid it with a Sight and Sound list, I think. But yeah, I think this was on that on that list, deservedly so. And like I said during the Eves Bayou podcast, I find like the economics of this, like the sociology of this, I find extremely interesting. Like what happened, where they go, and then when they come back, it does seem that every movie now that gets a wide release that stars Black actors is very much trying to educate the audience about what being Black is like.
Yep.
In America. Whereas
I would say even the small ones
is just about who these people are.
I would say even the small ones, because if you're thinking about,
oh yeah,
like Last Black Man in San Francisco,
mm-hmm.
like that's about as small as it gets, right?
Yeah.
You know, like people didn't even, I didn't even know that movie came out until I saw it on Amazon Prime. So, and we're here talking about movies. We're in some chat talking about movies every freaking day. And I didn't even know that had come out. So I'd say there are all of them. I mean, I'm sure there are some, but, and a lot of, and you know what? I'd even be willing to say there that the sum, a lot, like 80% of the sum, the small amount of movies that are just about, you know, people and they happen to be Black, are, a lot of them are probably sequels to old movies that are come from this era. Because, like, they just made a fourth Best Man. And they made it, I think they might be turning it into a TV show. So it's like, I'm sure there's more, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Hey, Epps got to get work. Getting back into 11 Basketball specifically, I'm really interested in what you thought didn't work. So, yeah, please.
Yeah. The only things that really didn't work was Monica and her mom. And it's not, it was like, not necessarily everything that was happening between them. It was like when they were in scenes together, it just didn't really work well with me. Like the dialogue might have felt like it was forced and off. Maybe the acting had like dropped a little bit in those scenes. But for the most part, it was that. That was it. And then a little bit of the dad. Like a little bit of the stuff happening with the dad felt a little off, like he just kind of disappears for a little bit and then comes back. And it felt like there should have been more. There should have been more interaction between Omar and his dad, and a little bit more like of them facing off instead of him just kind of fucking off after like that one day, him calling him a bitch or whatever, and then like. And then he fucks off for 5 years until his knee explodes. I mean, I get it that there's a 5 year time skip or whatever, a 4 year time skip, but it just felt like there should have been a little more vitriol between the two of them and have it shown on film. But other than that, like I said, I love this movie. But those are the only two things I could say.
I mean, that part of it, I think, is kind of the sneaky best part of the movie. Like, seeing how both main characters relate to their parents and, like, the coming-of-age aspect of this movie where they start as these little kids and then progress into adults. Seeing them progress through, like, the different quarters that the film is broken up into, where Quincy moves from wanting to be like his dad to rejecting his dad and doing the opposite of what his advice is, like jumping into the league too early, not paying attention to his experience after he's retired, and ignoring like the advice of someone who's been there, and Monica, who like really does not want to be her mom, who feels rejected by her mom, and then both coming to terms with their parents at the same time they're coming to terms with each other in their adulthoods. It's really clean. It's really like knotted up really well. I mean, you don't get really anything from Monica's dad, and you don't get as much from Quincy's mom. But with like Alfre Woodard as Monica's mom and Dennis Haysbert as Quincy's dad, I think they're both as interesting, if not more interesting, than Quincy and Monica. And like you're saying, it, like you wanted more from them. I completely agree because those actors are so great, and what they're going through in their lives, I think, is so compelling. Especially like the mom, especially just how she's related to her daughter this whole time, and like I mean. I am from a family of six children, and your parents can't go to everything. So, both my parents were really never like at my track meets, and I didn't care then. It didn't bother me, or maybe it did. Who knows? I don't know. But just like that, that expectation of support from your parents and how you react to it, if it's less than, it does stick with you, and you feel like you know how you should respond, even if you don't feel that way. And I feel like a lot of that is in Monica's reaction to her mom and how she rejects her interest and just doesn't, again, just really does not want to be like her at all. It doesn't think that she's lived up to her potential in her life. It's stuff that the movie doesn't have to have, but it has it anyways, and is so much the better for it. Like it would be a very good movie if it was just the love and the basketball, but in adding the coming of age part, I think that really like boosts it.
Let me be clear. I just want to say, I don't think that they were bad.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's, for me, it was like, just, I wanted more of the specific aspect of between Quincy and his dad. I wanted to see him fight a little bit more.
Mm-hmm.
And I just, like, some of the scenes with her and her mom, they felt off. That's all. It's not like I'm like, those scenes sucked. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I get it. It's just like,
those scenes, they felt off, like the one where she comes home and her mom just kind of drives away. I think it's maybe there's like too much silence, or, you know, like it lingers a little bit too much or something. But like I said, that's my only complaint, you know?
Sure. I mean, and I hear what you're saying, but I can just like make excuses for both of them. Just like how Quincy and his dad are both very proud people. Like they're elite athletes. So when it comes to like their area of expertise, like they're just not going to want to hear from somebody else about how to do it, or you did it right, you're doing it wrong. They're just not going to want to hear that. And like a level of betrayal that Quincy feels from his dad, I just totally buy that they wouldn't speak to each other for like 5 years. And like with the Monica and her mom stuff, I think I just totally get her mom. Like she just understands that this person doesn't need a lot from me. She could never give much to her because their interests are so apart, or they're so combative with each other. So like at a certain point, like, yeah, I'll cook you dinner or breakfast or whatever, but we've established a nice back and forth. We've settled into like a relational groove, and I don't feel the need to change it unless you tell me it. So yes, I'm going to just drive off to go where I'm going, as opposed to like lingering and really checking up on you, because you've never needed that before. And like we're revisiting this relationship in their adulthood when she probably does need that. She doesn't have a good way to ask for it because their relationship has been so, you know, combative and tense for their entire lives. And you see that.
Yeah, yeah. I'm cool with that. Maybe well, I'm trying to like maybe put it a different way, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah, when you write like a 6-paragraph review, you gotta have to bang all this shit out and like turn it over in your head.
Yeah, yeah.
You're welcome to jump in and like I'll tag you in if you ever want to, JR. I'm happy to do that.
Yeah, I totally believe that they wouldn't speak for 5 years. Mm-hmm. I wanted to see them hash it out a little bit more, other than that one time he called him a liar. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. That's what I'm saying. Everything is believable. Everything is believable. Except to me that we don't see them hash it out one more, at least one more time, between him calling him, telling him he lied to him, and him saying, you know, the dad being like, I did what I, you know, when the women are knocking on your door, yada, yada, yada. And then 5 years later, when he tears his ACL. I think there needs to be.
There needs to be more scene.
One more hashing it out.
That's fair.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I'm not saying everything else isn't believable. Shit, I mean, there's like, I have friends I haven't talked to in a year, and that's just on accident. You know, like, you can easily, purposely not want to talk to someone who you believe has done you harm and fucked you over easily for 5 years. 100% believable.
Yeah.
It's just, I just wanted to see a little bit more, and I think the same, maybe like, not necessarily wanting to see more, but just there's like, something was off with Monica and her mom.
I gotcha.
Yeah.
The sports aspect of the movie, I think, again, I think this movie does a fantastic job with it. Basketball is like hard to get on camera just because so much is happening on the floor at any given time. It isn't a one-on-one game. It doesn't really like distill down into like a cinematic standoff between, you know, one player and another player. It can, but that's just not organic to the, like, when we reviewed Blue Chips, like, directed by William Friedkin, a serious director, the basketball in the movie was trash. A lot of frenetic cuts. And I don't think he really I don't think he had ever actually seen a game of basketball before in his life. I think Love and Basketball does a fantastic job with, like, the thousands of decisions a player has to make in any given moment while they're playing basketball. There's a sequence in Monica's head where it's like a first-person perspective, and you see her and you hear in her voiceover, like, all the choices that she's making and all the recommendations she's making to herself. And she's reminding herself not to do this and to do that. And like, the big character moments within the game are all, they all have this really nice, like, structure function pair where Monica is a hot-headed player in high school. And then when she gets to college, she'll cause a turnover in a game, and then instead of like freaking out about it and like intentionally fouling someone, you see how she's progressed because she runs to the other end of the floor and like takes a charge in time. That's just such a perfect way to utilize her character growth within a credible basketball game. And I have so much I do think this is, without having like a long list of basketball movies in front of me, I think this is one of the better, if not best, portrayals of the game.
I concur. I don't know. There's not really a lot to say about that. You know, outside of what you just said. I mean, it all looks good. I mean, they're moving slightly slow compared to other movies, but it's like, that doesn't matter in this instance. Right, you're zoomed in on Monica and you're really just focusing on what she's doing, and like you said, you get growth and you see the difference between them, and between her in high school, you see the difference between her and as a 10-year-old,
mm-hmm.
and then in high school and then college, and then shit, she's winning European League championships against her old college foes. And then they're cool afterwards. Not something you'd see.
100%. That would have been just so cheap and boring for her to like. I mean, at that point in the movie, she's got to get back to the U.S. So one way she could have got back to the U.S. is if like her old roommate, whose spot she took, does a cheap blow or something and she hurts herself.
Yeah. Or they fight.
Because
they still hate each other or something. But they're just like. She just says they're grown now and they're cool with it and they're hanging out. And then she just makes the grown up decision that it's time. Like, I'm done.
Which, thanks again to how like detail oriented this movie is, you totally get how lonely she is and how she's not really putting herself out there in Spain. She's not, you know, pulling European dick like her old teammate is. And yeah, like the same thing is happening to Quincy in this last part of the movie too, where like this is a thing, basketball, that the leads both once loved and their whole lives were built around it, and it turned into a job, and they don't feel the same way about it anymore. And like the melancholy of that, I think it's portrayed really well, especially compared to like how they're talking about it in college. And it's just another perfect wrinkle in this movie that just has its arms totally around these people's progression through the game. Like they're both as successful as they could possibly. Like Quincy's, you know, he's like a journeyman or whatever, and like his career is over by the end of the movie. But just the fact that you get into the NBA is an incredible accomplishment. And I mean, he left school after his freshman year to be drafted probably pretty high up, if the movie is like telling you the truth.
Yep. And not only does he not, at the end of the movie, he doesn't have a professional career. Dude's sitting on the sideline with his wife starting in an NBA, a WNBA game.
Mm-hmm.
With his kid.
Of all the periods when this movie could have been set, like lining it all up so that it ends whenever the WNBA started is just is perfect. It makes so much. It's so intuitive.
Like, and it's actual WNBA people too. It's not even like fake bullshit. It's like Lisa Leslie's literally sitting next to her on the on the seat. Like, it's great.
Yeah, like the first time I was watching, it's like, well, when is this set exactly? I knew when the movie came out, and like, why isn't this set in the present day? Like, oh, okay, it's written into the movie that's going to end. It's like extremely calculated that we're, like the final destination of the movie. Yeah, it's fantastic, great movie. Last thing is the love part of Love and Basketball. I just wrote a review of Bros, a movie that I really did not like. I gave it a D on the site. That movie tried to get a lot of currency out of being like a gay romantic comedy, forgetting that romantic comedies are inherently bad. And they're bad because they stick to the formula, and the formula is boring and inorganic. And I had the realization while I was watching that movie that I don't so much hate Bros as much as I hate standard romantic comedies, which it very much was. Love and Basketball is not a romantic comedy, but it is a romance, and it figures out ways to naturally split Quincy and Monica apart. They don't have some bullshit misunderstanding. They don't break up because Monica thinks some girl is looking at Quincy too lustily, and she doesn't like it, and they fight, and she's a jealous stereotype, and just... They break up for a well-established reason. You understand why she does what she does. You understand why he is upset about it. And it's a totally rational thing for, like, 19-year-olds to encounter. I just have so much appreciation for, like, a movie that doesn't treat the audience like an idiot, like Bros does. And then, like, the iconic status of the final pickup game. Horny as hell. Something we don't get as much in movies anymore, just general horniness. And Love and Basketball's got everything going for it. This is a great movie. This is an A.
B plus. I've come up to B plus for sure.
So Love and Basketball is Gina Prince Bythewood's first movie. Her latest movie is The Woman King. This is a historical epic centered around the Agoge, the all-female fighting force of the Kingdom of Dahomey, which was a 19th century Western Africa kingdom in more or less where modern Ivory Coast or Benin or Togo is in that area of Western Africa, south facing on the continent, if you can imagine it in your head. JR, what'd you think of The Woman King?
I thought it was pretty good. It's probably like a B. It's just a B. Like it, I don't know. It was, some of the like subplots were a little weird, I think, mm-hmm. and maybe mm-hmm. didn't need to be there. But the idea, the idea is great, like, to tell this story. And then, I mean, the acting is good. You got what's her name? Tuzo or something?
Tuzo Mbedu.
Yes. And you got, I mean, Viola Davis, anything she's in, it's Viola Davis. Like, you're not going to get a bad thing.
Yeah, she's not
out of her. So the acting in this is good. And it was just like, there was nothing that was like great about it. There was nothing that was bad about it. It just sits perfectly in a B for me.
I have a soft spot for historical epics in general that are like military or political focused. So this hit me right in the sweet spot. I really like this. I'm a little higher than you. I gave it a B plus on the website, mediacommovie.club. I again, like Love and Basketball, I appreciated the scope of it. I appreciated most of the subplots and like the way that it approached what was going on in this period of the movie. Let's just jump into it. Pretty thorny period of history and a pretty thorny period of the world. Like, this movie gets made because of the all-female fighting force. But then you, like, read a little bit deeper into the Kingdom of Dahomey. And, I mean, I referenced in my review that every contrarian anti-1619 project person, like, the first thing they'll say, well, no, the first thing they'll say is the Irish were slaves too. The second thing they'll say is black people sold African slaves to European slavers who took them to America. They're so proud of themselves for knowing this little tidbit. And this movie is about one of those slaver empires. So, JR, how do you think the movie handled that fact, that facet of history in this movie? Like, because if the movie's not just Tuzo Mbedu plays like a new recruit to Viola Davis's general, but the king of this empire, played by John Boyega, is also in the movie. Like, this is about high-ranking officials in a slaver empire. How do you think it managed that, hard needle to thread?
I mean, I think it, I don't know. Like, you know what I mean? I have no idea. Outside of them talking about it the couple times or whatever, where they like, what's his name? Oh, Jesus. John Boyega's character was like, we're not doing that anymore. And they were like, hey, this, you're about to get fucked up if you stop selling us people. And so it didn't really, and maybe I missed this. I don't know how I would have missed this, but I just didn't feel like it really was addressed that much outside of those things. You know, whenever they had their people get attacked, they weren't down with it, but taken, they went in and killed them and whatever, but they never really addressed that they were selling out slaves and stuff.
Mm-hmm. I think, like, the standard for these kind of movies is low. Like, the Patriot exists, and however many other movies about, like, medieval knights and lords who functionally have, like, slaves on their lands, in they're serfs, they can't leave. The Last Duel is one of my favorite movies of, like, 2021, and that movie's about, like, high-powered landowners who functionally have slaves. So it's not, or, like, any movie set in Roman times. Like, come on, what are we doing? So this isn't a deal-breaker by any means. But I do think this movie handled it pretty well in that it acknowledged that we're in a position where we have to do this because this is not a big kingdom. They're surrounded by all kinds of little, like, city-state level kingdoms. And if anybody gets a leg up, they'll start to shrink us. And how you get a leg up, you know, like, the most profitable industry is going out and capturing slaves and selling them to Europeans. If we're not going to do that, we are endangering our own people.
It's also this is not something I've like looked into much, just kind of heard. I should do a little bit more research. Maybe just cut this part out after I say it.
Mm.
Block this here. We're going to 1, 2, 3. We're going to give you good cut section so I don't look like an idiot on the internet. But it's like their thoughts of slavery is like totally different than the Europeans at this time, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Like the idea that you would be born a slave and your children are slaves is like, well, no, if I escape, I'm not a slave anymore.
Yeah.
And like, I'm going to be able to melt into the population. No one's going to be able to find me.
Yeah. I mean, that's what the women are doing in this. They literally like capture these people and they're like, you can either join us and fight or whatever. So mm-hmm. Yeah, I just wanted to make sure I had that right. Like there, it might be a slaver empire, but it's like, it's not, what is it? Chattel slavery.
Yeah. So like they're in commerce with people who are doing chattel slavery.
Yeah.
But yes, that's not their tradition, I guess you would say. But I do think the movie acknowledges like this is putting us in danger. This is like the most powerful person. Like if the king gets captured, it's not unreasonable that he would also be sold, put on the same slave ship with everybody else, and shipped to America or the Caribbean or Brazil or wherever. So I think the movie finds a way to let its characters reject this way of life, even if it's ahistorical and that is not what happened. In my very minimal understanding of, and really what I take away from The Woman King is that there are just as compelling stories at this level as there are in like the Middle Ages in Europe. They're kind of organized in the exact same way. And the same things that I find so compelling about medieval stories in Europe just as much apply to any like African kingdom. So more movies in general about those. Yeah, that'd be great. But I came into The Woman King very wary of, is this going to do the Patriot thing where the British roll up on Mel Gibson's plantation and are like, all your slaves are free. And the slaves are like, oh no, we choose to work here. We're not slaves. Mel Gibson is the one good landowner in North Carolina or wherever he's from. So everything's fine. We don't have to feel bad about this. I don't think the movie did that. I think the movie is like engaged with like the corruption of this empire. Even though I think it likes John Boyega's character, like he's not a dick. He's not. I mean, he has a harem of wives or whatever, but I don't know. They seem pretty cool with the whole scenario.
Yeah, they're just a little bit mad that he also listens to Viola Davis.
Exactly. Yeah, instead of them. Yeah. So that's the recognizable dynamic. He's not. Yeah, he's an oppressor in the sense that he's a king. But in general, he's not better or worse than any other king. We mentioned how it spreads out focus between Viola Davis and the new recruit. I definitely think people could land at this like division of labor differently. But I enjoyed getting like two movies in one. You get the high-level political stuff with Viola Davis and John Boyega. And then with Tuzo and Betty, you get like rising through the ranks and like finding comrades within your basic training group and conquering tests and et cetera, et cetera. So I liked having both of those within the same story. And then, again, I could also see someone being irritated by like the randomness of these two people coming back into each other's lives, like Viola Davis having given up her baby years ago when it turns out it's Mbedu's character. I don't know. That's all fine with me.
It didn't
bother me.
I thought that was whack.
Okay. Yeah, that's fair.
That seemed like some We were just talking about Les Mis earlier. Mm-hmm. That's some Les Mis bullshit where they just happen to be running into each other fucking years later or whatever. Like, that's like one of the only parts I don't like about Les Mis. I mean, it has to happen, but it's like, this just felt like it was ridiculous. Like,
this happy coincidences and that kind of shit. Yeah.
Like, this movie is the same movie, and in my opinion, a little better if it's just a random person. Not like the lineage of some fucking badass character you already have. It's like, and this, god damn it, this is like all the time I have to somehow I come back to shitting on Star Wars, but this is not Leia, not Luke.
Everybody's the same family.
Make people just be people. They don't have to be family and shit.
Yeah, that's all fair. You mentioned some of the side plots not being as interesting as others. I would put like the Portuguese characters in that basket of the like the not interesting basket. You don't need either. You don't need the white one. You don't need the mixed race character either. The mixed race one shows up at the last minute to like save somebody. If I remember, I didn't rewatch this movie in advance of this last round of movies. I watched this back in October, I think. But yeah, I think he shows up at the last minute to save somebody. You can contrive a way to have somebody else do that or not need the save to the last minute scenario in the first place. I just don't think they added anything.
They didn't. I 100%. That's the people we 100% are on the same page there. They're just like, what the fuck is this?
You kind of imagine like the writing process of it. Like, does this movie want all the villains to be black? And like including the Portuguese allows that to not be the case. So I don't know. I wonder if one follows the other.
Maybe. Yeah.
I mentioned my love for these kind of movies. Something. And I mentioned The Last Duel too. The Last Duel is like 3 hours long. And there's like a 2 minute section in there where like the female lead in that movie takes over her estate for a little bit, and she's just walking around and like suggesting improvements and getting to know the blacksmith and the horseman, stable master. I love that shit so much. I like Ridley Scott, who directed The Last Duel, does that incredibly well. Like Kingdom of Heaven has great sequences like that. You don't spend a lot of time on Maximus's farm in Gladiator. You see it when it's burned to the ground and like his family has been crucified. That's kind of it. But anytime there's like an old timey agricultural scene or like an old timey artisanal scene or craftsman scene, I love that shit. I don't know exactly why, but I think that's great. Like even in Robin Hood, which is not one of Ridley Scott's better movies, I think the only version of that I watched was like classic Ridley Scott extended edition, like 30 minutes of extra footage just mixed in, and like that has an extended beekeeping segment that, if I remember, is like my favorite part of that movie. And The Woman King has a tiny little section of it when they start to move away from slavery and into like, I want to say, sorghum processing. This movie solidifies its status if that segment is longer and more in depth. If you could like see progression in the sorghum process, how are they doing it? What do they need? How much are they generating? All of that commerce. I want that so badly. I didn't get enough of it in this movie. Maybe there's an extended edition of The Woman King where that is more in depth. But that's the difference between like a B+ and an A-.
You are sort of
processing.
Yeah, I mean, coming from someone who just told me their favorite book of all time is Les Mis.
Sure. Les Miserables.
This sounds
not right. Les Mis. Not definitely sorry. Not Les Mis.
Sorry.
Disrespectful.
Yeah, my sorry, Victor Hugo, or whoever the fuck wrote that book.
He didn't get buried in the pantheon to have his book shorthanded.
Let me put some respect on this guy's name. I'm so sorry.
Goddamn right. Last thing I want to say about The Woman King, unless you have something else, is Tuzo and Bedu. I didn't watch Barry Jenkins' Underground Railroad. I think we mentioned that in like in a TV episode we did a while back, where it was Pachinko last year, like an important series that I started that I really liked that I couldn't get through. And then the previous year in 2021, that was the Underground Railroad. Like, there was this important series made by a premier filmmaker, Barry Jenkins. And I just never started it. And I should. It does kind of feel like homework. I'm sure it's fantastic, but I'm also sure it's hard to watch. And she is the star of that. She is like the second lead here. And she is great, Tuzo and Bedu. Really bubbly, like a memorable face. She's like, he looks a specific way, like nobody else in the world looks like her. Really able to like hold the camera and like go opposite of like runny-nosed, crying Viola Davis in like her peak Viola Davis mode. She's just incredibly impressive, and I hope this gets her more roles.
Yeah, I'll agree with you. I also haven't seen The Underground Railroad. I have read the book. Yeah, that is based off. It's a good book. Like, so I'm looking forward. It's one of those movies, you know, I just keep adding shows to the list and I keep picking off the top instead of like going through the list and actually picking something. And I think if I were to go through the list the next time I need something to start, I think I probably would pick this, but inevitably this won't get watched until 2025 because so much good TV is coming out right now.
And that very much is like, seems like a show where it requires your undivided attention. You can't put it on while you're washing dishes or whatever, doing a crossword puzzle. Like, that's a sit in front of the couch and really like intently watch this thing. Anything else on The Woman King?
No. Nope.
Solid historical epic. Probably a B+ is too hot. but I did really enjoy this more than I thought I would. Our last movie is What's Love Got to Do with It. This is a movie directed by Brian Gibson, a director of no major accomplishment. This movie really didn't really do too much after this. Kind of a gun for hire. This is a Tina Turner biopic. In the era of biopics before they like really ran themselves into the ground, I think. I don't think this one does. This one is not as bad as biopics will eventually become. I think this one is perfectly fine, anchored by a great lead performance in Angela Bassett as Tina Turner, and led by just the great choice to make a movie about Tina Turner. JR, what do you think of What's Love Got to Do with It?
Great movie. B+ for me.
All right.
The acting, for one, incredible. From both leads, opposite each other. Lawrence Fishburne, I can't. Like, just in general, I can't think of a movie where he's bad. Anytime. Right? Yep. Same thing with Angela Bassett, but I think this may be them at their peak, both of them. You could argue, you know, maybe Lawrence Fishburne in The Matrix is his peak, where he gets to peak there, maybe, or maybe like...
I guess it depends what his peak, like if this is his best performance.
His best performance.
I might say Boys in the Hood.
That's good, too.
Like from the same period.
Yeah. Yeah, around the same time. Also, like, he's technically in Mystic River. He's good in that, right?
But I don't remember that at all. Does he do anything in Mystic? He's just, like, Kevin Bacon's friend?
He's just in Mystic River.
Okay, yeah.
But
all due respect to Clint Eastwood, I don't think he's not going to direct Lawrence Fishburne to his best work.
Yeah. Yeah, Clint Eastwood is not going to be like, hey, black guy. Okay. Surprised he was even in the movie, actually. But they're both great.
Yeah, the movie doesn't really... Mystic River doesn't really need him. How much familiarity... Well, what's your background on this movie? Like, have you seen it? This is from 1993.
I've seen it, like, three times. Like this. Okay. I rewatched it a couple days ago. This is probably my third or fourth time seeing it, you know?
Gotcha.
It's the movie when anytime you're, like... You know, we watch a lot of movies, so anytime you tell a black person, like, I watch a lot of movies, I look at the Oscar. I watch the Oscars. Black people are like, they robbed Tina Turner in 1989. She should have won fucking Best Actress. And you're like, okay, right. Which I'm not saying she shouldn't have. But
I did look at the Oscars for this year. Like, Holly Hunter won for The Piano this year, which is like a totally opposite performance. She's deaf in that movie, or mute. Yeah. She's mute.
You're gonna win the fucking movie.
Win the Oscars. Like, that's a fine win, but like, yeah, this is the kind of role that you win Oscars for. It would not have been surprising at all if she did win.
Yeah, but it's great. I enjoy it. It's got lots of iconic stuff. Some, you know, if you ever hear people say "eat the cake," like "eat the cake" anime, that's from this movie. You know, you got all this stuff. But I think it's a very good movie. It's just not great, not good enough to be an A- or better.
That's fair. I mean, just the biopic stuff.
Yeah.
It's not as bad in this movie because this movie is not about Tina Turner's whole life up to 1993. It's only up to like the mid-70s, approximately, like just after her divorce from Ike Turner. And like, that's what the movie is about. Like, doesn't necessarily have to be about Tina Turner as much as it is about a woman escaping from a bad marriage. I wrote in my review that, like, without looking into, like, the history of the Lifetime channel, I choose to believe that an executive at Lifetime saw What's Love Got to Do With It and was like, I can make 100 movies based off of this exact same structure, and then proceeded to do that. Maybe that's the case, maybe it isn't. Tina Turner in general, I didn't like know all the details that this movie provides. There's a long chunk of the Wikipedia page that is just about inaccuracies. Whatever, I don't really give a shit. A huge appreciation for Tina Turner in general. Like Proud Mary, one of the great combinations of like song and performance. I've been watching a lot of Proud Mary like concert YouTube videos over the last week or so since I watched this movie. Angela Bassett did not sing for this role. I think she got it too fast. She didn't have enough time to prepare. I'm sure she would have attempted to if she had more time. But what she gets exactly right, what she throws all of herself into is like the dancing and the onstage persona. We got to talk about her arms.
That she's ripped?
She is fucking ripped. Almost to the point where it's distracting. Where they put her arms pull so much focus in the movie. Maybe she overdid it. It's really close. It's really close.
Isn't Tina Turner like super ripped in like those days though too?
From this period, I don't think as much.
Okay.
I think she was a little more waifish in like the 60s.
That's fair.
But
I mean, she had gotten older, so that would make sense. But
yeah, and like Angela Bassett is in her mid to late 30s while this is being filmed, and like she's being asked to portray like a 17-year-old too. She probably ages into her actual age by the time the movie is over. But yeah, the teenager stuff doesn't work as well. And then, yeah, she's like a bodybuilder on stage. It just all goes to the physicality of it. And it's a lot of fun to watch, but like she is like Michelle Obama wishes she could have Angela Bassett's arms because Michelle Obama is being like humiliated if there's any comparison.
It's true.
Yeah. Also on the physicality of these actors, I had to double check on Ike's 60s haircut. In fact, as terrible as
yes.
Lawrence Fishburne has to go through.
Lawrence Fishburne, if it tells you anything, looks better than Ike Turner did in this movie.
Oh, yeah. And he looks pretty goddamn ridiculous.
Yeah. Like, Lawrence Fishburne looks absolutely fucking ridiculous in this movie. Because, I mean, who the fuck dresses like this? But it turns out Ike Turner did. And since he doesn't look as good as Lawrence Fishburne does, he looks much worse.
The movie does a pretty good job with it, like where that haircut comes from. Like they make an offhanded mention about the Beatles and the British invasion. And then like a scene or two later, there's been a time jump. And now Ike has this Beatles haircut. I got to wonder if that's a wig or if like Lawrence Fishburne had to walk around with that hair for like a few weeks, however long it took to film those scenes. It's pretty funny.
He's got the hair, and then what? Three scenes later, then they're all like fucking smoking weed in this room, and he's got like a feather hanging off his fucking ear or his hair or something too. You're just like, this fucking dude is just like trying to ride these waves like hard.
I came out of this movie having no respect for Ike's talent. As the movie goes on, and it portrays him. I'm not apologizing for Ike Turner, a famous asshole Ike Turner, but I didn't get I don't think the movie doesn't give you a sense of what he's contributing. Especially as the movie continues, like into the late 60s and the 70s, where he's just like stalking around in the back of the stage and not even like getting on the mic and doing his like bass intro to Proud Mary. You just get no sense of what he's contributing.
Yeah. I mean,
he's in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame too.
But do you know any Ike Turner songs?
I don't know. And then like Proud Mary is like a cover. So yeah, I don't know. Like a lot of the original, like the Tina Turner songs that I know are like the post Ike songs, like What's Love Got to Do with It.
Yeah.
Like the theme to Thunderdome.
I'm right there with you. Like I literally don't know.
I mean, that is something that Tina Turner herself has like an issue with this movie where like we were together for a long time. There was a reason for that. It's not that she would quibble with like her status as a victim. He was contributing, not like to the act and to the marriage. It wasn't just a question of like I'm terrified of this man, as you know she surely was from time to time. But there's a documentary on HBO that came out in 2021, I think, where she talks in depth about this, and I really want to check it out. It's because this story is so fascinating. I do think the better movie is the one that doesn't take as much time in her life. But it's just, the better movie is she's just been divorced. All she got was her name. She has no, like, recording rights. She has no money. She has no home. She has these four kids, two of which aren't even hers. And, like, just trying to make a go of it in that period between, like, I think it's, like, 74 to 76 or 77. Before she gets like signed again, before she starts like really performing again, like that period I think is the most interesting part. Like that's like a classic movie too, where like she starts at the bottom and then unjustly starts at the bottom. Like she's been like cast back down by this piece of shit, and she manages to like claw her way back to like performing in Giant Stadium or whatever. And like that's the end of the movie. This movie as it is. There's the arc is still there, but just like getting out of this bad marriage, and I think Tina Turner would say as much too. Like that's not the proudest part of her life. I think she's probably a very proud person who was like, show the shit that I did by myself, like building a career by myself, instead of like me being slapped around and raped by my husband.
Yeah, Jesus.
Yeah, that the choice to set that scene like surrounded by these fish tanks is incredibly striking, and very as Brian Gibson did not have an exceptional career, but like that is so disconcerting. There's something about that. I mean, no rape scene is going to be a pleasure to watch, but that one was like especially. There was just something about it that really put me off.
It was long, too.
Yeah.
Like, and it's maybe because it was also less violent than you're used to in rape scenes that happens in movies, you know? I don't, not to say that this wasn't violent,
yeah,
but it was like a lot of them that happen in movies, there's like punch it, there's like the whole time people are like fighting, you know, and it just like at some point it seemed in this movie she'd, when it was happening, kind of just given up and just was like, fuck.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. It's, I exclaimed. I was like, God damn, or Jesus, or whatever, whatever I said. Yeah. Rough scene. But again, great choice of subject. Gives you all the, like, the catalog, gives you all the great music, gives Angela Bassett a chance to like perform as Tina Turner. Extremely cinematic when she gets on stage. Solid cast of backup dancers. Candy Alexander's in there. She's great. But yeah, pretty standard. Pretty standard for a biopic. But anything else on What's Love Got to Do with It?
No, I think it's a great movie. It's just like, it's there. There's no like, this is, we have all, there's not a lot to talk about this movie because it all is just kind of laid out. It's sort of like when we watch like Daughter of the Dust, you're just watching it and it's like super fucking, this is like Daughters of the Dust was super fucking good and there's not a lot to talk about. You're just like, this is awesome. You know, this happened and I don't like this part. Not a lot to say anymore. This one is the same, except it's just like that type of thing with a B movie where you're just like, it is what it is. And you're watching it. Everything's good. Everything's great. Or everything's really good. But it's just like, it's off. They didn't do anything bad. It's just the potential of the movie. It hit its full potential. I don't think they could have made this a B plus higher movie. Like you said, except for, you know, maybe show her struggling to support herself. But even then, does she actually in those years? Do we know that? Do you know that?
Does she actually what?
Struggle to support herself.
Oh, yeah, yeah. In my understanding, I'm sure this is in the documentary. But I think there's been more than one documentary, too. But this most recent documentary. My understanding of that documentary is, like, the impetus is, this is the last time I'm going to talk about this period of my life. Tina Turner saying this. So she gets maybe pretty in depth.
Gotcha. I'll have to check it out.
Yeah. I've that's been on my radar for a while. And again, like with Underground Railroad, it's one of those things that you don't get to. That'll do us for this episode. Our next trio, we're going from black female led movies is Ruben Östlund is Danish, I think. So the opposite of that. I think he's Danish. If he's not Danish, he's Norwegian. Yeah, I don't know. He's Scandinavian, I think.
Whatever it is, it's the opposite. No matter one of those, whichever country it is.
We're not doing Ruben Östlund, I think, made movies before 2014. But as far as his breakout movies, his movies that like penetrated the like American critical sphere. We're talking about Force Majeure. We're talking about The Square. And the reason we're talking about Ruben Östlund is Triangle of Sadness. We're doing these movies because Brian won our Oscar pool pretty handily. Pierce and myself, I think you did pretty badly too, JR.
And
I didn't. Seventh.
I just,
the idea was that you submit ballots before all of the guilds give out their awards and it starts to become obvious. And I did horribly. Pierce did even worse. Pierce was oddly optimistic about Elvis, which I think might have been just like a self-hating move. Like, I think the Oscars are terrible and I'm going to vote for what I think is the worst thing they could possibly do. I liked Elvis.
I still don't get it.
We don't need to rehash that.
Yeah.
Those are all, well, two are great movies. All three are interesting. Stay tuned to find out which one is merely interesting as opposed to great. You can read reviews of these last three movies and so many more at MuticaMovie.club. You can like us on Facebook at MuticaMovieClub, Twitter at MuticaMovieCole, and Instagram at MuticaMovieClub. Thank you for joining me tonight.
No problem.
Have a good night.
You too.